May it please the court, Peter Gregory on behalf of petitioner Metro Taxi. This case is governed by well-established principles of insurance coverage. Principles which Metro asserts have largely been ignored by the Industrial Claim Appeals Office, which I'll refer to here and after as ICAO, by Pinnacle and by the Kondracki division of this court. As set forth in the briefs, there is a complicated procedural setting to this case. This case is before the court on the ICAO's affirmance of a denial of a petition to reopen filed by Metro Taxi. As is set forth in Metro's briefs, Metro's position is that the threshold issue to be addressed by this court is whether there is coverage under the Pinnacle policy. If there is coverage under the Pinnacle policy, and the ICAO is reversed on that issue, then there are two divergent ALJ orders. One holding that Metro is not insured under the Pinnacle policy for Sakal's injuries, and one holding that the claimant has coverage under the Pinnacle policy for his injuries. And as I will address a little bit later, it's the presence of those two orders that creates a legal limbo down at the Industrial Commission, or pardon me, the Industrial Claim Appeals Office. And those orders now need to be addressed and the coverage sorted out and determined whether Pinnacle, in fact, has to pay benefits for Sakal.
Mr. Gregory.
Yes, sir.
Isn't that dilemma or that conflict one of Metro's undoing? Metro told the court, told the ALJ, that this policy, the Pinnacle policy, did not apply and consented to dismissal. And now you want to say that the ALJ erred in doing exactly what you asked the ALJ to do.
Well, there are two things. There are two responses to your question, Judge Jones. The first is that the agreement was to dismiss Pinnacle without prejudice. And the reason that that agreement was entered into at that point in time was that Metro was taking the position that Sakal, as well as other drivers, were independent contractors and not employees. And that is why Metro took the position that Pinnacle could be dismissed without prejudice. When it later came to be determined that Sakal, in fact, was an employee, there was then an attempt by Metro Taxi to implicate the Pinnacle policy because of the language of the policy. It was at that point that the ALJ determined, erroneously we contend, that Metro Taxi was barred by issue preclusion from raising that issue again.
But I'm wondering why you just didn't invite the error. I mean, the petition for reopen asks or alleges that the order of the ALJ was erroneous in dismissing Pinnacle. But that was expressly what you asked the ALJ to do. To me, that's just invited error. You can't complain of something you asked the court to do.
But I understand. However, it was a dismissal without prejudice, which is distinctly different than a dismissal with prejudice. The other factor that plays into this is that in the workers' comp setting, petitions to reopen are judged under a liberal and broad standard because the normal concepts of finality of judgments are not applicable in the workers' comp setting, and that's why you have a petition to reopen.
It sounds like here, whoever made the decision thought it out, examined the policies, made a call as to what the policies covered. This wasn't an accident. This wasn't an oversight. This was a strategic decision, a reasoned decision, to ask the court to dismiss Pinnacle, conceding that its policy did not cover this.
And I understand what you're saying, Judge Jones, but the reason that decision was made was because of the position of Metro Taxi at that point in time, that its drivers were in fact independent contractors. Once they were determined, and particularly Mr. Sakal was determined not to be an independent contractor, they revisited the issue and made an attempt to determine if there in fact was coverage under the policy, because at that point, rather than simply being an independent contractor, he was deemed to be an employee. And that is the principal focus of our argument, which is we've got to look at the policy and see what the policy says.
Counsel, as I understand the procedural posture here, the ALJ, the second ALJ to view this, basically assumed without deciding that the Pinnacle policy did cover. Is that correct? And then concluded so that there was, everybody was proceeding on a legal mistake, but this is not the kind of mistake that can give rise to reopening. This was the conclusion of the first ALJ. And then the panel went on in affirming that order essentially to say there was no coverage.
Correct.
Okay, so your view is that we have to decide whether there is coverage. We can't simply assume and then review that review, that ruling.
Right, because, well, yes, I think you do need to get to the coverage issue. Because if you determine that there is no coverage, then
there's no mistake.
There's no mistake in denying the petition to reopen. So the issue here is really that both Pinnacle and ICAO unduly focus on the policy information page of the Pinnacle policy and on the misnomer that there are covered classes of employees set forth in this policy.
Mr. Gregory, do you disagree that the policy information page was part of the insurance contract?
Oh, I absolutely do not disagree. It is akin to a declarations page. It forms a part of the policy. The issue, however, Judge Taubman, is that if you look at Pinnacle's argument and you look at ICAO's decision and you look at the Contrachi division's opinion, they essentially looked right at the declarations page and stopped. And they said there are three classes of covered employees. Here's the problem. Nowhere in the case law nor in the policy does the term covered employees appear. In point of fact, when you read the policy, the insuring agreement, which is where we start any coverage analysis, says we, i.e. Pinnacle, will promptly pay when due the benefits required of you, i.e. the employer, by the workers' compensation law. Now, I have Pinnacle and the Kondraki division treated the listing of three classes of employees on the policy information page as if that was an exclusion. Well, as we know, exclusions have to be specifically set forth in the policy and have to be clear to be enforceable.
Well, as I read Judge Webb's opinion in the Kondraki case, he wasn't relying on an exclusion, but rather an inclusion, because the information page specifically listed three categories of employees.
Well, there's a reason that three categories were listed, but my argument, Metro's argument, is that unlike any other policy, well, pardon, let me rephrase that. Unlike, for example, the employer's liability section of the policy, which sets forth an insuring agreement and specific exclusions, the workers' comp part of the policy simply says that the obligation on Pinnacle is to promptly pay when due benefits required of the employer by workers' compensation law. Nothing in the statutes and nothing in the policy says to pay for certain select classes of employees workers' comp benefits. Now, the reason that I believe the Kondraki panel focused on that is because the panel didn't look at how the rest of the policy works. The way the policy works, and I've set forth in great detail in the briefs, and time prohibits me from going too greatly into that, is that a determination is initially made by Pinnacle as the insurer and the underwriter as to who the classes of employees are that will be used to determine the initial premium. And if you look at the policy information page where you see the listing of garage employees, salespeople, and office people, you'll note that it says an estimated premium. you cannot stop the analysis there. And indeed, I cited the Usick versus American Family case where the court said you cannot just view isolated parts of an insurance policy in isolation. You have to look at the whole policy. When you do that, you will see that there are numerous provisions, particularly in Part 5 of the workers' comp coverage of the policy, that indicate that the classifications assigned to determine the estimated premium are simply a best guess and an estimate, and that the premium is subject to modification and audit if the exposure is greater at the end of the policy period. Also significantly, two points set forth on page 23 of the opening brief, and these are critical points, I believe. The first is, if there is no ability to modify the policy later, and in particular the premium, and if the determination of classes of employees is wholly immutable as set forth in the policy information page, then why does the policy contain multiple provisions in subsection 5 allowing for audit, allowing for determination of the actual exposure phase, and allowing for a back charge of premium? Secondly, if you look at Part 5...
Let me just answer that rhetorical question. Why wouldn't that be limited to the number, say, of office workers or garage workers? In other words, why not an audit just to determine how many of those there are?
Well, I mean, could it be? Yes, it certainly could be. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at classifications, Part 5, subparagraph B, the classifications, i.e. the classes of employees, were assigned based on an estimate of the exposures you would have during the policy period. And so if the class, and it goes on to say that the classifications can be changed. You can add additional classifications of employees later and back charge the premium. The other important point on page 23 of the opening brief and in subsection C of Part 5 is that the premium basis, as indicated by Pinnacle, is determined based on all your officers and employees engaged in work covered by this policy, okay, and two, critically, all other persons engaged in work that could make us liable under Part 1, workers' compensation coverage of this policy. This gets us to the essential nub here. We have a situation where a worker is deemed to be an employee. Once he's deemed to be an employee, you have to look at the policy and determine if there's coverage. And the coverage is not for particular classes of employees, it's for the employer. One final point. We've heard before from Pinnacle, and we may hear now that Metro is merely trying to game the system. No, that's not really true. There were economic reasons that Metro attempted to classify drivers as independent contractors. Critical point. I'm sorry, I wish I'd said this earlier. You will know from the briefs and from the record that when Metro applied for coverage with Pinnacle in 2004, the Pinnacle underwriter was, quote, initially reluctant, end quote, to write the policy without the drivers. But the Pinnacle underwriter then satisfied herself that the drivers were independent contractors and did not factor the drivers into the premium mix for the estimated premium. So in terms of gaming the system, we simply have a situation here where Metro's efforts to have these drivers be independent contractors under 40-11.5-102 failed. Ultimately, both Pinnacle and Metro was wrong regarding the classification of the drivers, but trying to find coverage under a policy that would want not only protect Metro, but also would protect the employees' rights to recover benefits in the event something untoward happened with Metro is a matter of insurance coverage, and we would ask that the order be set aside. Once you find coverage, then there are two divergent, may I finish the last sentence?
Please.
There are two divergent orders, which then amount to a mistake of law and warrant setting aside the ICAO's order remaining for further proceedings.
Counsel, let me just keep you up on one question.
That's fine.
There's no structural reason, is there, why an employer such as Metro couldn't buy two separate insurance policies to cover its employees. Let's assume the Metro knows that the taxi drivers are employees. They could contract with AIG to cover the taxi drivers as employees at one rate, right? And Pinnacle added the other employees at a different rate. Or am I wrong? Is there any structural reason why that would be disallowed?
Structurally, no.
Okay. You're just saying that here that didn't happen because of the language of the policy. Absolutely, please.
Structurally, no. But ultimately, you have to come back to what the policies are going to say.
Yeah.
And if the policy says, we will pay benefits which you, the employer, are required to pay under the workers' comp law, then if I bought two policies, ostensibly, I may have two policies that cover me as the employer, even though they were kind of underwritten for two sets of employees. I think structurally, it's conceivable. Economically, you'd never do it.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Doug Rucksager. I represent Pinnacle Assurance. I think the facts just stated are a little bit distorted. When the claims representative for Pinnacle, the underwriter, testified that she looked at the request for insurance from Metro to see if Metro was treating its drivers as independent contractors. If Metro had wanted a policy for drivers, we would have written it. That's the business of Pinnacle Assurance. This was a very high dollar premium, and there would have been no reason not to write it. The only reason it wasn't written is because Metro came to Pinnacle and said, we already have coverage for our drivers. We don't need it. We want a policy that covers our other employees. So the underwriter looked at the documentation provided, convinced herself that Metro was treating its drivers as independent contractors, and said, all right, we'll write a policy that covers everybody except your drivers since they're independent contractors. That's the policy they wrote. And if we back up a little bit from there, Metro is the one that lobbied the legislature for this statute that allows them to insure their drivers outside of the Workers' Comp Act. Back in 1992, it was Metro who came to the legislature and said, hey, we don't want to cover them under the Act. We want to cover them separately. Give us another provision. And the legislature did that. They wrote a statute in the Public Utilities Law, which has nothing to do with the Workers' Comp Act, that says common carriers such as Metro can insure their drivers' liabilities outside of the Workers' Compensation Act. That was in 1992.
Mr. Rucksager, what's the difference between the two kinds of insurance? Because as I understand it from the briefs, the alternative AIG insurance here is required to be similar to workers' comp.
That is true. And it started out that issue started to arise in 2004. The statute that allows Metro to insure outside of the Act says they have to provide similar coverage. So in 2004, Metro bought the policy with AIG. After they bought the AIG policy for the drivers, they came to Pinnacle. They didn't need comp insurance for Pinnacle, so they didn't ask for it. Then there was a case that came out after the policy was written, the USF case. And that first started the question of what is similar coverage. And that did not involve Pinnacle, it did not involve Metro. It basically said, it was a little unclear at that point, but it basically said similar coverage has to be something pretty close to workers' comp insurance. Well, that didn't affect our policy. It didn't affect Metro's policy. Metro did nothing different until 3 years later in 2007, Metro was faced with its own case where that was the question. That's the Gebrekidan decision that we mentioned in our brief. In Gebrekidan, the question was whether Metro's policy was similar in coverage so that it complied with the statute under the Public Utilities Law. And the ALJ said, no, under USF, we don't think this is similar, so there's no coverage. Metro appealed that and lost. They appealed to this court and then settled the case and withdrew the appeal. So after Gebrekidan, Metro knew its policy was insufficient under the AIG policy to cover drivers. So as an employer, and by the way, the employer has the duty to insure its employees under the Act. 844-101 places that duty on the employer, not on the insurer. So once Metro was penalized in Gebrekkadan, it was faced with a couple decisions. We need to go back to AIG and get similar insurance. Or we need to go to Pinnacle and say, we want to insure our drivers. There's 500 insurance companies in the state. They could have gone to any of them and said, we want to insure our drivers. They could have gone self-insured. But what did they do? They did nothing. They knew they weren't covered, and they gambled with their policies, what they did. They started paying claims out of their own pocket. So instead of paying Pinnacle $1 million a year for premium, instead of paying AIG for more premium, they just said, we'll take the chance. And that's essentially what they did. They paid smaller claims out of their own pocket. They knew there was no coverage under the policy. If you look at the briefs, nowhere does Metro say, oh, we intended to have coverage under the policy for drivers. That just wasn't the case. They came to Metro Pinnacle after they had already insured their drivers. So why would they buy comp insurance? They didn't.
Schmoofsager, would you, I'm sorry for being so halting here. Would you explain to me one more time the source of Metro's responsibility to provide insurance that is essentially similar to the kind of coverage that would be provided under a workers' compensation policy? And my question specifically, just for purposes of my information, does it rest on the determination that these taxi drivers ultimately are employees, or regardless of whether they're employees, is there some separate obligation to provide to independent contractors coverage that's roughly equivalent to workers' compensation?
Yes, there is.
Okay, and that's in that common carrier statute.
Exactly.
And it would apply just to common carriers. Somebody else who hires an independent contractor has no obligation at all to provide.
That's true. Okay. That statute is an exception for common carriers to ensure
their drivers.
Their drivers.
Okay.
Outside of workers' compensation.
Thank you.
Now, Metro makes this argument that somehow the premium section means that everybody's covered under the policy, even though the policy information page clearly lists the covered classes. That argument reflects an understanding of basic workers' compensation law. When you buy a workers' compensation insurance policy, you don't pay a premium up front. It's always estimated. And that's because the premium is based on employer payroll. You never know at the beginning of the year whether employer's payroll is going to be over the entire year. So you know how many employees are there to start. You estimate the premium. At the end of the policy year, you do an audit. You see if they had that number of employees covered under the policy. And if so, there's no adjustment. If you had more employees, there's an adjustment, you owe more premium. If you have fewer employees, there's an adjustment, you owe less premium. And so every year you do an audit and you get a final premium statement. That's what happened here. Metro says, well, Pinnacle should have just audited this to see if there were more people. First of all, we're not just talking about more people in a covered class. There were 80. We're talking about 421 more people in a different class, taxi drivers, which is extremely expensive class, which is why the premium would have gone from $25,000 to $1 million. But in any event, Pinnacle did audit. In fact, every year they sent a renewal statement with the same classifications and asked if anything was different. Answer, no. Every year they sent a final premium statement saying, here are the classifications, is anything different? No. In fact, Pinnacle went on site and did in-person audits. They specifically asked Metro, what about your drivers? And they were told, oh, we got it covered. They were specifically asked, are you paying these claims out of pocket? Metro says, no. Now, Metro knew they were. They were just simply avoiding the premium. And for $1 million, that's the position they took. ALJ King, or one of, actually might have been the ALJ in the other case before King, Kinesi, just essentially said they went there. They knew what they were doing. This is a sophisticated company that's lobbying the legislature for an exemption under the statute so they don't have to pay comp. That's what they did. They shouldn't now be relieved of their responsibility to pay this claim.
Sir, you agree with your colleague here that we do need to decide the issue of coverage?
No, I don't.
Okay.
In fact, I think the issue of coverage is the basis for denial of the petition to reopen. But Judge Kane below assumed there was coverage. I mean, we have Judge Friend's order. We have three orders from Judge Friend and every which way. And Judge Kane basically assumed there's coverage.
But even if you assume there's coverage,
That doesn't mean the claim is reopened. The claim is reopened when there's a mistake justifying reopening, when there's an unfairness that needs to be rectified. And Judge Kane looked at that. He said, first of all, let's look at the mistake. Metro loaned for 8 years prior to this decision. They didn't have insurance. They represented to every judge prior to this that there was no insurance. Their general manager in this case testified the drivers are not covered under the Pinnacle policy. They're not covered. So when they get to the pre-hearing conference that counsel mentioned, the issue of dismissal without prejudice is a red herring. Number one, you can dismiss a case, say it was without prejudice, and under the Brody decision, which is at 594 of the record, it doesn't matter what you call it, it's what the effect of the order is. And here you had claimant, this was claimant's claim against Pinnacle that was dismissed. It wasn't Metro's claim against Pinnacle. Without prejudice, issue is a red herring. In any event, they allowed it to be dismissed. They went to hearing on coverage. They said we're covered under the AIG policy. They made another stab at the similar coverage issue. That's what they were relying on. They're saying we have similar coverage. AIG said, no, you don't. They appealed it. They lost. They didn't appeal anymore. So the coverage issue, they've known about. They've had all the same facts, all the same legal arguments. Their experts said, yeah, we knew about this 2 years ahead of time. L.J. King said, that's not the kind of mistake that you make. Under the Klosterman decision, excusable neglect is not a basis for a mistake. If excusable neglect is not a basis for a mistake, how could a conscious decision not to get insurance and then to dismiss Pinnacle as a party be the basis for a mistake? We don't think it can be. When you look to the question of fairness under reopening, it's even more compelling that the case should not be reopened. Here, you have first the question of premiums. Pinnacle provides the insurance they want, and now Metro says, we get $8 million worth of coverage for free. And that's what their experts said. We can't go back and get it. Essentially, you gave it to them for free. Well, how is that fair? That's not an injustice that's going to be rectified by reopening this case. You have all of the situation where, in fact, where Pinnacle went and asked about the drivers. This isn't Pinnacle sticking its head in the sand. Pinnacle asked them, what about the drivers? They're covered. Are you paying these out of your pocket? No. I mean, what is Pinnacle supposed to do? Pinnacle doesn't have a responsibility to insure. Pinnacle can't make them buy insurance. Pinnacle acted responsibly. Metro did not. One of the most significant things, I think, in this case, is that Metro sued their insurance broker for not getting the insurance that Metro now claims they had. And they recovered money. So they're asking you to say, we don't have to pay premium. Oh, there was coverage under the policy, even though we didn't ask for it. And we sued our broker for not getting us that insurance. But Pinnacle, you have to pay the claim, and we don't. That's not rectifying an injustice. That's creating one. Pinnacle pays a claim it doesn't receive premium for. Metro doesn't pay the claim that it knew it should pay. Metro gets a windfall by recovering from their broker. That's not a basis for reopening the claim. And by the way, it's worth noting, the claimant didn't brief these issues, and that's because claim is being paid. This case does not involve the question of, is there a source of recovery for claimant? Claimant's being paid, didn't brief the issues, Metro's paying claimant, and claimant's not pursuing Pinnacle. Pinnacle shouldn't be in this case. We haven't had a chance yet to appeal Judge Friend's order below, involved only claimant, did not even involve Metro, and we will. I think if this court follows the other division or enters its own order under its own reasoning, I think Friend will vacate his prior order, and I think fine, things will be straightened out in this case. I mean, there are orders going everywhere down below, and it all rests right now on whether this case should be reopened. I think ALJ Kane hit it right on. Even if you assume there's coverage, there's not a basis to reopen the claim. So he denied it. ICAP did that too. They went further and basically said, not only is there not a basis to reopen, we affirm on that grounds, but there's no coverage. And six bodies now have found the same thing. Two ALJs at the Division of Workers' Compensation have held that. Two separate appellate bodies at ICAP have held that. Judge Morris in the Denver District Court has held that there's no coverage here and that it was Metro's obligation to get it, and they didn't get it. And then we have the Kondracki Division of this court, which said there's no coverage. And I know that's not binding precedent on this division, but its opinion is so succinct. I mean, if I could write my brief again, I'd take their order and write it, because it's flabbergasting to me how we can stand here and say a party who did not ask for insurance, did not pay insurance, saved $8 million worth of insurance, sued its broker for not getting that insurance, can turn around and say, but hey, somehow there's insurance and you have to pay. That's not fair. And that's what reopening is about. And just to address counsel's point about this one section of the statute that says the insurer is liable for people that we could be liable for. That, again, is just a misunderstanding of how comp works. In workers' comp, you estimate your premium beforehand, but you may then hire people after in those categories of coverage. Well, you don't know ahead of time that those people are covered. So the policy says we're liable for people that may become liable, that you may become liable for. That's after hired people. That happens all the time. That's not a provision in the premium section which allows you to increase add a class, add 421 people, and provide $1 million worth of coverage for. It's a premium calculator. And there's actually one other way that works, and that's just the whole statutory employee thing, which we don't need to get into, but it's when you have a certain type of work and you contract it out and those people get hurt, you're liable for their injuries. So that's what that provision is talking about. It's not talking about this case. There's no misclassification here. Metro knew what it wanted. It got what it wanted, and it should pay the claim. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.